Hey, welcome to Big Jim's Garage. Big Jim O'Brien, your host here. Do a morning show in Detroit, but we're listening online and people checking in from all over the country. A couple of really interesting interviews. We're going to go from self-driving cars to fast-driving cars. Good morning, everybody. It's a documentary. It's been shown a couple places. It's its first Midwest premiere here. It's called Autonomy. Documentary, autonomydoc.com. Alex Horowitz is the director. We're going to talk with him first. And then we're going to shift gears. Another car reference, everybody. About it. Scott Dixon, who's become one of my favorite interviews. Scott Dixon, five-time IndyCar winner. They're getting ready. Think about what he's got going on. He's doing the Indy Grand Prix this weekend as we record this on Friday. Indy Grand Prix. And then the Indy 500, and then two races at Belle Isle, and then Texas, and then the 24 hours of Le Mans. Back to back to back. I get tired picking up groceries from the store. We really get into what we're going to talk with Scott about. Not only Indy and the buildup for it, but what's going on with the cars this year. He had a little incident with Graham Rahal as well. So Scott Dixon coming up in just a second. But first, Alex Horowitz, Autonomy, the documentary, coming to the Motor City, the Cinetopia Film Festival, Sunday, May 19th. How you doing, Alex?
Good. How are you?
Wonderful, man. Thank you so much. Had a chance to sit down and watch the movie. Now, you're going to be here, the Cinetopia Film Festival in Ann Arbor, Sunday, May 19th, a week from Sunday, at the Michigan Main Auditorium, kind of closing the whole thing out and then heading over to M-City.
That's right.
Now, to me, I think it's always interesting, you know, that our perception of vehicles here in the Motor City, obviously, may be a little different from the rest of the country, but if you think about it, I don't know, we're on some level embracing autonomy with the technological surge and new companies we're seeing here in Detroit. Alex, there's companies here that I have never seen before in some of the tech corridors.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense to me. And I think that's just a testament to the Detroit area's spirit of industry. I mean, yes, it's true that for roughly a century, the car was, I'm going to say, relatively unchanged. Of course, there were many different advancements and the car got much safer, much more sophisticated. But that was all sort of like a linear progression of the car getting better. And Detroit was certainly, you know, the city that one of the cities in the world that helped birth that. But now all of a sudden, everything's kind of upheaved. The technology we're talking about in my film, Autonomy, looks like a car, but it's kind of another thing. It's another beast altogether. And it really reinvents stuff. But Detroit has always been a city that's equipped for change and new things. I discovered a lot of that while making the film. You know, we made several trips to the Detroit area, filmed a lot there, and talk about Detroit as a city that builds new things.
Yeah, and you know, and one thing that I really enjoy in the documentary, Alex, is the fact that it's not dated. You're not getting into like legalities and things like that that would make it.
Right.
This is more of a bigger picture, like a macro thing for people. I mean, it's a big picture thing. And for so many people here in Detroit, when we talk about cars and the innovation, I always tell people, I said, you're less in control of a car when you're on the road. You're trusting someone else or something else more than you realize. I mean, just the basic idea right. of being in a car, you don't know what that person next to you, if they're drunk, if they're sober, if they're distracted, if they've got a death wish. I mean, I'm not being morbid, but do you think as human beings, we think we're more in control of stuff than we actually are?
I don't even have to think it. A lot of psychologists have done studies to indicate exactly that. We tend to have a very false perception of how secure we are in any given task we're doing. We also tend to have a very false impression of how good we are at physical tasks. We generally have a greater estimation of our own ability to, for example, drive than we actually have. That doesn't mean we can't be good drivers. We can be. But for sure, subliminally, we take a lot on faith, even if we don't think about it. As you said, you just sort of presume that the other actors on a road are going to do a certain thing. But as we know, when something unpredictable happens, the consequences can be grim. But I'm glad you pointed out, and thank you for pointing out, that the film is more concerned with those things than things that would make it dated. You live in a town where a lot of people are, I think, relatively well-versed in this technology, probably read up on it more than in your average city.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
But there's, you know, that kind of journalism that covers the industry and who's going to be first to market with a level 3 car, that sort of thing, that would date immediately. And my film's not particularly concerned with that. It is much more concerned with the big picture stuff, as you say.
Well, I remember like when the first Google car came out, the Egg, that was built. Yeah. I may get in trouble for saying this. I don't care. I mean, the first Google car was built over by Roush here in Allen Park, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones that built it. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like Google all of a sudden got in the car business. They did, but they didn't.
Right.
And Malcolm Gladwell addresses that a couple times during the movie, which, you know, when you see software companies, I think for Detroit, Alex, what we look at is the car is such a unique thing. I remember reading this a couple of years ago. There's more than twice the lines of code in a Chevy Volt than there is in an F-35 fighter.
You know,
so that level, how intricate this is, what people are operating to suddenly relinquish full control, the perception of what they call level 5 autonomy, where you just let it go. It's hard for people to do, and especially here in Detroit, because we are so tuned into this.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, that letting go of control is, to me, the crux of the movie. It's not, yes, it's a movie about self-driving technology, but more is the point. It's just about control and how we define ourselves through the things we build, you know, what happens as we progress technologically. And, you know, I found, as you saw in the film, I find a lot of analogs to this in our history, like, you know, the elevator, something as simple as an elevator that most people would not think twice about getting into. There were, you know, Park Avenue had to do PR campaigns in the middle of the 20th century for that lasted a few decades, actually, just saying, Ed, the automatic elevator, as simple as pushing a button, don't be afraid of it, because people wouldn't get in and trust a contraption that did that without an attendant. So it may be that, you know, fast forward a few decades, we wouldn't think twice about this stuff. But right now we're really in the middle of this crucible where it is beginning to be discussed at the dinner table. And I hope that the film just it serves as a tool to help people have more educated and informed.
Oh yeah. Alex, it's really well done. And you're not heavy handed on either side of it, which I appreciate. I mean, you made me think about it. And the gentleman in Germany, and I apologize, his name eludes me, the guy who really is like the grandfather of autonomous driving. I had never heard of this guy until this documentary. And that alone makes you want to go see this. I was blown away by that. How did you find this guy?
Yeah, his name is Ernst Dickmanns, and I will add to his name our Japanese pioneer,
right,
Sadayuki Tsugawa.
Yeah,
and you know, as I dove into the research, I just sort of found them almost literally as footnotes in other technical journals. There was very little about them. If you look on the web, you can find a couple little videos, sort of antiquated things of Dickmanns, but. These guys were doing stuff much earlier than I would have expected it to find this. And indeed, when I was interviewing other people in the industry, big names, you know, like people who had worked on the DARPA Grand Challenges, and I mentioned these names, that people were like, oh, I'd never heard of them, or, oh, yeah, it rings a bell, but I couldn't tell you why. And for my money, these guys are, to use another analogy, they're kind of the Tesla and Edison. I mean, these were really the Wright brothers in different hemispheres of this technology. So, you know, it's my good fortune that they're still alive and very much with it. They can be found, like their emeritus professor pages were on the internet, and I just reached out and there they were. So we interviewed Dickmanns in his home, and his first car, which I think he called the Vamorse car, was really doing this with just cameras, you know, basically what Teslas do today. In about 1984, I think, was his first test. Tsugawa's car predates his even. Tsugawa's car is like 1977 that he's doing it with just one set of stereo video cameras in Japan, 1977. Now, his car moved very slowly. It only worked within certain limitations. But, I mean, there it is. Those are the guys who invented it. So if my movie accomplishes nothing else, just to be a time capsule for the two of them and show off their work in a way that the world's never seen, I'm very proud of that.
Alex Horwitz with us, the director. If you just join us on Facebook Live as well, Autonomy is the documentary, autonomydoc.com. Coming here for the Cinetopia Film Festival a week from Sunday. It's going to be at the Michigan Main Auditorium, michtheater.org for tickets for more information. And, you know, I've actually spent some time with the Super Cruise in the Cadillac, the Level 3 Autonomy, 2 to 3, somewhere in there. And it's interesting with our hours, Alex, that I found myself by the second day, I was letting it drive me to work probably as long as it would go, 20, 25 miles. I had no problem with it. I didn't even think about it. I love the fact that I could, you know, you still have to look forward. You're still sitting there where you can take control of it. But mentally, once you release it, I don't think people could comprehend. You're so relaxed. I was in a better place when I got to the radio station in the morning. I was just relaxed. And that's only having it for a week. I can't imagine eliminating the stress of a daily commute where I can let my car do it for me and I don't got to worry about it.
Right. Well, you're a perfect case study for then why people think this is worth pursuing. You know, you know, you touched on a bunch of things there that are interesting. I mean, first of all, you're speaking to exactly that kind of sense of trust that is exciting but also dangerous,
right?
Because we've seen what happens in cases where people trust something. You know, you were using Super Cruise, but people who trusted Autopilot and Tesla a little too much too early. You know, we cover the Josh Brown death, and his death seems to be a case of that, where he was relinquishing too much of his trust and too much control. He wasn't paying attention, like you obviously were. So, you know, this is a messy, slippery slope. There's also the notion that, you know, the nomenclature and the language is so important, because when you call something, you know, Super Cruise sort of lets you know it's doing something like a cruise control, but I still have to pay attention. Autopilot, even though it's a comparable technology, it basically does, you know, it's a level 3-ish technology. It makes it sound like it's doing it for you, and it really is truly a self-driving car. But the truth is that there's nothing commercially available that fully drives itself. These are driver assistance tools. The idea of something at level 5, as you mentioned earlier, a purely autonomous pod, you know, that's theoretical right now, doesn't exist yet. And on the way to get there, level 0 through 5, it's very messy gray areas. And that's why I spend very little time on the 5 levels in the film, because I think they're probably going to prove themselves to be obsolete and not very helpful. You know, the way we talk about these cars does need to get codified, I think, in a way that makes us all feel like we understand it better and we know its limitations.
Well, let me ask you a question that I remember Jeremy Clarkson had done on Top Gear a couple of years ago. He was talking about autonomous vehicles and self-driving vehicles, and he thought up that, okay, you're driving down the road, and there's something in front of your vehicle that is unavoidable, and your car is, you're at a high rate of speed, and more than likely, if you hit this thing, you're going to die. The only way your vehicle can safely avoid it is to turn to the left, where there's two people standing on the side of the road.
Yep.
So it's either you or the two people on the side of the road. Now, as human beings, our survival instinct is such that whether we want to admit it or not, we're going to turn left. We're going to avoid the crash. We're going to take out the two people. Who or how? It's a great question. Who programs morality into a car? I mean, how do you program that where the car goes, well, there's one of you and there's two over there, so you're going to bite it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is one of the biggest and for me the most interesting and dangerous and exciting questions of this. We do discuss it in the film. Ultimately, you know, spoiler alert, we don't have those answers of who programs morality. You know, and you're articulating a certain version of an old philosophical problem, usually called the trolley problem, which has existed long before there were self-driving cars.
Right.
You know, you have the option to pull a lever to intervene, that would kill one life rather than many. You know, different permutations of that problem.
Yeah, the box. Remember the movie The Box, where you press the button? Yeah, you get $1 billion, but somebody dies that you don't know. Yeah, that.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah.
Different versions of that. I mean, you know, philosophers have not been able to come up with a satisfactory answer to that question before the self-driving car. So why would we be able to have a satisfactory answer now? And I don't think we can. I will say this much. Proponents of self-driving technology, like the engineers who are building these things, would say, first of all, if we do our jobs right, these cars will see that obstruction before you ever would, because it would have seen it with, you know, LIDAR or radar or its many sets of eyes in a way that you wouldn't. So chances are they will be much more adaptive and reactive and anticipatory than humans are. They're not there yet, but they can be. And secondly, and this is an interesting point that one of the engineers says in the film, you know, humans historically are very bad at things like the trolley problem. We have some people have instincts that go one way. Some people have instincts that go another. The answer you give to the philosophical problem, oh, well, I would do this instead of that, is not necessarily what your reflexes are going to have you do in the moment of panic. In moments of panic, humans do very unpredictable things. So why is the computerized version of that any less scary or any more scary than the human version? And the answer for many may just be that, you know, well, but it doesn't have a face. It's not accountable. And that's a question we all have to answer. Like, who is accountable when things do go wrong? Is it the programmer? Is it the company? You know, people have said, well, passengers will no longer be insured as we are today. The companies that make the cars are going to be the ones with insurance now. All things are possible. All things are on the table. My film and I do not purport to have all the answers. But, you know, I think now was certainly the time to make a movie that asks all the questions.
Yeah, and you do a wonderful job with it. Autonomy, again, autonomydoc.com, the website. It'll be here at the Cinetopia Film Festival Sunday, May 19th. Alex Horowitz with us, the director of it. And Malcolm, and I don't want to give it away. I want people to watch this. Malcolm presents a scenario towards the end of it that absolutely rattled me to my bones, talking about the...
I think I know the one, yeah.
Oh, my God, dude. That came out of nowhere, too. And all of a sudden, I just sat there going, wait, what? But he's got a valid point.
It's actually... coupled, I think you're talking about his catastrophic risk. I won't spoil it for people,
yes.
but just sort of
yes.
a worst case scenario of how things can go wrong. Yeah, I think it's coupled right next to our scene that we filmed at M-City, which we're going to have our closing night party at after the film festival. I think he's right to ask those things. I mean, look, there's I won't spoil the way he phrases it exactly, but it's some version of the idea that as we save lives on an everyday level, which may be the way this goes, you know, there are projections that say, well, if human error is responsible for whatever it is, 94% of crashes, and that could be eliminated by the perfection of this technology, well, then you do the math. That's how many fewer road accidents there will be. I mean, it's an astronomically large number of lives we'll be saving. But we may open ourselves up to new kinds of vulnerabilities and security risks that could, in one fell swoop, kill a lot more people than are killed in a car accident at any given moment. It's a possibility. That's all he's raising. And, you know, and I think we're right to ask these questions. I think we have to make sure that all of us as citizens can demand of the regulators that they be paying attention to these things. And as consumers, as the people who buy these cars and ride in these cars and use the apps that ride share these cars, we all get to, you know, sort of demand standards of the companies that make them and the services that provide them. So that's why I wanted to raise really scary questions like the one Malcolm does.
No,
so
it's
on our radar.
Yeah, but the documentary, it makes me actively, all I want is something that it makes me think afterwards, with, you know, and I don't want, you know, there are nuts and bolts documentaries and stuff, but this one about a car, but it's a mindset for our culture, the car culture and the Motor City. I mean, in the country, in the world, how we're doing this. I was thinking real quick, Alex, I know I don't want to keep you too long here, but I was thinking about this. Do you remember there was a period even before cell phones? And you touch on that in the documentary, how everybody goes crazy and lines up for iPhones, right?
Right.
There was a period probably 20 years ago where we were all obsessed with processors. Who got the latest Intel? Remember, that was the thing.
Right.
You had to get the new Intel processor. And now you're going with phones where it's, you got to have the latest and greatest cell phone. You got to have the bigger screen, the folding screen, blah, 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 blah. Were cars the first real device like that, where you had to personalize it, where it became that? I mean, we've always had status symbols, especially as Americans, but were cars the first expression of that?
Well, Eddie Alterman, who is, you know, chief brand ambassador for Car and Driver magazine and is a big voice in the film, and who will be on stage with me doing a panel after the film next week. That's certainly the way he phrases it. I mean, that's his contention in the film. I think he's probably right, at least in terms of an industry point of view, like that we can point to the car industry as the first to really actively exploit it from a PR point of view. Like they built in the idea that, you know, the 57 Chevys are coming, everybody's got to line up. I'm certainly not informed enough to point out something earlier. It's entirely possible that, you know, people obsessed over, you know, the latest kind of pocket watch before that. But technological advancement was at a slower pace, you know, before the automobile. It's when around the turn of the century with the assembly line, that's where things start getting perfected. And every year things are getting a little better. And now it's, you know, a gadget is obsolete by the time you take it off the shelf. So, I think the car is certainly a good way of pointing it out. It is sort of the birth of a new era in terms of personal mobility and personal technology, something that you own, something that, you know, lives with you at your house. That you sort of define yourself by, and that changes your life. And it was a huge shift at the time it came out. You know, a story I like to tell before screenings of this film, and you'll apologize to anybody who's going to be there next Sunday. You'll hear me tell it again before the screening. But then I think it was 1997 or 1999. You know, somebody got off of a trolley car on Central Park West in Manhattan and was struck by a taxi. It was the first death at the hands of an automobile in the United States and one of the very first in the world. And one of the national headlines read, "The automobile has tasted blood."
Oh, I mean,
that was the kind of hysteria in what was supposed to be objective journalism that we were dealing with. Now, you know, that headlines like that and fears like that it spoke to didn't do anything to slow down the advancement of the automobile. You know, the horse and carriage was still destined to become obsolete and something that, you know, was relegated to sports and, you know, personal riding out at the stable. So, you know, if there is a central thesis of the film, it's that change comes and change is coming. And I'm as a filmmaker, and I'm agnostic about whether this particular change is good or bad, let's just talk about how it's going to, how it's inevitably going to, and what are the different ways it could play out. So I take for granted that people are going to be just as scared of self-driving cars as they were of the automobile tasting blood in 1899. But I'm sad to say, you know, that it's sort of beside the point, because here it is and it's coming. And we now have to talk about the most responsible ways for it to evolve.
Fantastic stuff, man. Again, everybody, I would highly encourage you, especially here watching in Detroit, if you're on our Facebook live feed as well, autonomydoc.com. I'm looking at the camera right now. Michigantheater.org for tickets. Cinetopia Film Festival. You guys will be there a week from Sunday. Alex, I appreciate the time. You did what, like I said before, you made us think about autonomous vehicles in a broader sense and how it impacts our culture, and not just here in the Motor City, but worldwide as well, man. Well done. Well done, job. Really nice job on this.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Okay, man. Alex, thank you. All the best, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. I hope all your listeners come out next Sunday.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Yeah, I told you, it's a really interesting documentary, and I've spent some time in self-driving cars, and I don't know, if you get time, try the Super Cruise. If you know somebody's got a Caddy, it may change your mind, or it may just freak you the hell out. Okay, we move on from self-driving cars to race cars. Scott Dixon checked in with us here, getting ready for the Indy Grand Prix, and then, of course, the Indianapolis 500 and the Detroit Grand Prix here in the Motor City, where we record this, DetroitGP.com, and we talk a little bit about Belle Isle as well. He's got so much going on. Such a great guy. Hey, Scott.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's an honor, bud. So let me see. Grand Prix of Indy. Then you get ready for the 500. Then you got the double shot here in Detroit with the Detroit Grand Prix. And then you head over to Le Mans.
Then Texas, then Le Mans, then Road America.
Right.
Yeah, just keeps going, man. So it's as I said, you know, it's a good problem to have, you know, better than the alternative of not driving at all. But yeah, it's a busy time of year, but you know, for me, I actually love the transition, especially going, you know, from ovals to road courses to sports cars and bouncing around. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's always fun to me. Like two things when you're driving the road course at Indy, it just sounds weird to say that, but anyway, like I noticed right away you're going the wrong way. So that, you know, for in your mind, and obviously maybe it's just a stupid question, is there ever a point during the Grand Prix of Indianapolis you're like, oh my god, I'm going the wrong way?
It's the weird part is actually pit lane. So we, you know, and to make it even more confusing, you know, through the month or 2 weeks leading up to right now, you know, we've tested on the oval, then the road course and the oval, and then we'll go back to the road course and then back to the oval. So it's actually pit lane feels weird because you kind of, you're turned around the wrong way, then you go in the other way, and then you go straight out onto the track one direction. So yeah, but you pick it up pretty quickly. So you try not to make any mistakes.
And I see that one, too, the first two turns, the right-left transition turn, kind of, you know, that bleeding off speed, it's very similar to what we see at Belle Isle. Well, it is. I mean, that kind of setup with a longer straightaway afterwards. Is that a mindset for road courses? Is that something they use to bleed off speed or just to get you into the technical part?
Yeah, a little bit. I think, you know, the 1-2 section of Belle Isle is actually a lot more fun just because it's a lot more high speed. You know, you're third or fourth gear there. You know, the one at Indy is first gear, second gear, a lot slower, a lot flatter. You know, you've got a lot of even elevation change at Belle Isle. So, you know, yeah, they do that with certain tracks here and there. You know, some have a very flowing sweeper corner to start with. But, yeah, you know, I think, to create good passing, I think you've got to have big straights and then, you know, areas where you do, you know, take a ton of speed off. And, you know, at Indianapolis, we're going almost 190 miles an hour into turn one and then down to first gear, like 40 mile an hour corner. So it happens pretty quickly in about 300 or 400 feet.
I saw Joseph on Dale Jr.'s podcast. And they were talking about heart rates. Now, he was saying that at some points he gets well over 190s. I would assume that's the same for you during a race.
Yeah, it depends. You know, everybody's heart rates are a little bit different. You know, mine, I think if I got to 190, I'd probably be, I'd be dead. But, you know, it's super physical, man. Like these courses nowadays and the physicality, especially of an IndyCar, you know, we're probably the only formula at this level. Yeah, we are the only formula at this level that doesn't have any power steering or any assist. So the steering weight is very high. We're getting to, you know, 5-6 G in some of the corners, some of the ovals, like Iowa are very, you know, high G load as well. So it's super physical, man. It's much like a triathlon for, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours, and then Indy. And some of these smoother ovals with longer straights just mentally are so tough, though, because the car is so light, so on edge. And, you know, you've got, you know, 32 others that, you know, are going similar speeds. But, you know, as we all know, if you touch or hit each other, you know, it can go badly very quickly.
it's kind of like, you know, it used to be, especially when it came to like when you watch Le Mans back in the day, any endurance racing, Sky, you'd always talk about how, you know, you got to save the car, save the equipment. Well, now it feels like when I'm watching Indy, it's like the driver, you got to save yourself. I mean, as far as physically, so you're there at the end of the race physically to take that car back to that edge, or are you there the whole time?
You're flat out now. Even the endurance races, you know, Daytona 24-hour, Le Mans 24-hour, it's literally a 24-hour sprint. You know, there's no the reliability and you know, the way they make these cars now and the stress levels, you know, they make them almost indestructible, which makes it, you know, tough on the drivers and the teams to run at that level. You know, you used to be able to go out and run 6-7 tenths and then turn it up, you know, to 10 tenths for the last, you know, couple of hours or 3 hours. Whereas the IndyCar races, they're the same. They're just flat stick from the get-go. And that's why I think there's been a lot of emphasis on, you know, the driver physical training and what you do, you know, leading up in preparation. You know, it's become a totally different machine now.
Yeah, I love in the movie, Scott, too. It was really fun to watch the light, that board you were doing. What was that?
Yeah, so there's the Dynavision one. There's lots of different light versions that we use now. But, you know, reaction has become, you know, the difference is, I think, in simple terms is, you know, when I first came into IndyCar, you know, I think test days, I probably did almost 50 to 60 test days. Now we're limited to about 5 or 6. So, you know, you used to be able to race ready and race fit level. You know, you wanted to be just constantly driving. And you could almost in those days where you had test teams and you'd be running a lot in the car. Whereas now you're out of the car a lot more and you're having to do the physical side, you know, whether it's, you know, cycling, running, swimming, to all the weights, to all the reaction stuff. And we do it a lot of times with high intensity intervals too. So, you know, at that point, you're not really thinking clearly and you're still having to do these math equations and these light boards. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to really, you know, flood the body and exert it as much as you can. Just so, you know, for the scenario, like at St. Pete this year was a really physical race. That at the end, you know, you can give it your 10 tenths.
So I was watching the Kentucky Derby. I don't know, did you watch the Derby this weekend?
I only saw the replay, but man, yeah, okay. That's crazy.
So is that kind of what Graham did to you in Long Beach?
I guess the difference with you know, the Derby is you've got a horse that's kind of got its own mind, right? So it's that one was definitely tricky. I think it was, the first time in the running in the history of Derby that call had been made. But I don't know. It's always subject. You know, Long Beach was definitely a tricky situation with, you know, the thing that I got to make clear is I have no say in that, right? You know, I came into the pits and the decision had already been made. So it was obviously, you know, pretty abrupt and something they didn't think was right. But, you know, we'll cruise on. Graham still, you know, is and has always been a great friend and we'll be racing hard again.
That's what I liked about it. I was going to say the thing that I don't like the blocking and everything else. I mean, it's racing to an extent, but I love the fact that you guys both addressed it and Graham could have gone full whoever, Kyle Busch, but he didn't. I mean, you know, he talked about it. He said he's going to talk to you. He didn't agree with it, and you addressed it as well. But that's – do you think that's going to become more – not the blocking, but I guess the blocking is going to become – these cars feel like they're getting closer and closer. When you guys – especially on road courses, you and I have talked about this many times, Scott, the difference between first and last, there really are no back markers anymore. And you guys, it feels like the field just draws together. You're going to have this kind of aggressive driving on every road course.
Yeah, there's different levels. I think, you know, yes, you can defend, but you can't, you know, drive somebody clearly into the wall or react to, you know, the following car. You know, I think we see these big crashes, you know, on a road or street course. If you look at, you know, Dario's crash that ended his career in 13, you know, it just takes one of these movements to get into the fence and you know, that's what happens. So, you have to be careful. I trust me, I don't mind racing hard. I love racing hard. I think that's what we should do for the fans. You know, that's what the sport's about. But you have to be very careful not to go, you know, over top of that. And I think, you know, personally, I think IndyCar have been doing a good job. They've let us race. They've let us touch, you know, in situations. But, you know, there's always a limit to that. And, you know, I think over time, we have seen that over probably the last 2 or 3 or 4 years where, you know, the stewardship has continued to be the same, that you get a real good feel of it. So I think everybody knows what they should and shouldn't do. And, you know, sometimes we push the boundaries and that's what happens.
So just hypothetical here. I know you love these. If you can only have one, the Indy 500 this year or a win at Le Mans?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, I don't know. I'll take the 500, man. I don't know, though. I've only finished third. We finished on the podium the first year at Le Mans. The team, the sister car, actually won that year. But I'd love to get a win at both. I don't know. I want to say both.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's a competitor in you, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It is. Are the cars? Is it a different feeling we have in the car for a second year? I mean, to have this platform now, do you guys feel more confident with the vehicle and how far you can push it?
Yeah, I think so. Specifically talking like the 500, you know, I think last year we saw maybe a little more separation than we typically have seen. You know, which I think is good. You know, I think it's not. You know, the best car and the best driver should win Indy. It shouldn't be a lottery system, which I think for a period there, you know, sort of 13 through 15, it was you know, kind of dicey in that scenario where you had almost pack racing at Indianapolis, which, you know, it's fun for the fans to maybe watch, but, you know, you're not really getting the real winner out of that scenario. And I think last year we saw, you know, Will was clearly, you know, the class of the field and he deserved to win and he was able to pass through and even with strategy shifts and things like that. So I think this year they'll tighten the field a little bit. You know, I think some of the aerodynamic stuff they've done, Firestone have done a tremendous job at bringing a better tire. Last year we had this issue where you would get, you know, two or three cars back and you try to tow up behind somebody and on, you know, the middle or the exit or the corner, the front would just wash out and it wouldn't come back. So it was very, very difficult to drive and very difficult to stay close. So I think they've definitely looked at some of those issues and made some good gains. So I think the race should be fantastic this year.
Yeah, I just finished Adrian Newey's book, which is fantastic. It's a great read. But that's the one thing, last thing with you, Scott Dixon, our guest here, scottdixon.com, at scottdixon9, obviously, and driving to Chip Ganassi. That one thing, Adrian, that we talk about the difference between mechanical and aero downforce, you know, when you guys come out, I don't know how you get away from that you create cars with that kind of aero downforce. When you pull out, you're going to have that parachute effect. That's just the nature of the car, right?
Yeah, it is the nature. And you know, we've seen it since we've had wings. You know, I think the issue is that, you know, that it became very aero-dependent. And Formula One is probably the worst-case scenario of that. And well, you know, where and how they've tried to fix that scenario. But still, you know, their races, by the time they get through turn one or turn two, you pretty much know who the winner's going to be. You know, it's kind of... The tires change right each year because of, you know, chemicals they can and can't use. So I think, you know, those have been harder to build to the higher levels that we maybe saw in the 80s and the 90s, and especially in the tire wars. So, you know, you're then relying on aerodynamics a lot more again. But, you know, I think with Indy, you're so trimmed out. The difference with us too with IndyCar is that everybody has to run the same aero package, right? So IndyCar can change it, you know, at will, whereas in Formula One, you know, it's very difficult. You know, each team has to build to, you know, their own specific levels. So
right.
It's a fight that we all fight. You know, I think you see it very prominent in NASCAR right now. They're really struggling with their races and you know, they're really putting emphasis on the aero side that's hurting it. So it's a tricky situation, but you know, I think with technology and that these days, you know, you will see some, you know, some clear differences. But IndyCar have got a pretty good handle on it.
I can tell you, as a fan watching, Scott, the racing is as good as it's ever been. First to last, everything is just fun to watch. And I know you want to get a win this weekend, obviously, with the Grand Prix, and then, you know, get on a roll like that. What's next? I mean, you got the Grand Prix of Indianapolis. Do you just keep the same mindset? Do you just like, I'm going to go to this track and I'm going to win, and that's it?
Yeah, you gotta try and do what Will did last year. He swept them both. You know, he won the road course and the oval, and to have a month like that at May would be a dream month. And that's our goal. That's the number one goal. That's all we're focusing on. And we'll start, you know, this weekend with eyes set on trying to get the Grand Prix win, and then straight on to Indy. So hopefully we can pick up both.
You're the best, man. It's always great talking with you, Scott. We're looking forward to seeing you, obviously, here in Detroit with the Detroit Grand Prix, and good luck through the month of May and beyond. So much going on, dude.
There is, man. But I love it. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Scott.
See you, mate.
That's fun, man. Scott Dixon for that. Alex Horwitz, our other guest. Autonomy, the documentary. AutonomyDoc.com. MishTheater.org for tickets. Detroit Grand Prix tickets. DetroitGP.com. IndyCar is red hot right now. you want to reach out to me, you can hit me up on Twitter at WCSXJim. Email bigjim@WCSX.com in the Motor City. Going to be busy, man. Lots of racing going on right now. IndyCar all over the place the month of May. I'm going to try to get Mario on. We're going to talk with our buddy Mario Andretti. He's been on a couple times. 50th anniversary of his win at Indy. And Marco is driving the paint scheme on this year's car. And I even put in a request for Fernando Alonso. Yeah, that'll happen. You never know. Thanks to Pat at IndyCar, by the way, for making that interview happen with Scott Dixon. All right. Drive safe. Later.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.